Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parvajitakara Sakura Sri Shima Samayam Grace Aishi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jaya Iskand Foundry Chari Shri Prabhupada Ki Jaya Samadhi Bhakti Vinni Ki Jaya Gaur Vinanda All glories to some of the devotees All glories to some of the devotees All glories to some of the devotees All glories to Shri Guru and Shri Guru Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Staya Vipade Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityananda Namaste Saraswati Om Gaura Vyasa Kamayana Visheshi Shri Hari Sasuke Kodi Sakaram Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 Reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 6, Text 30, Creation of the Universal Form, Text 29.
Pratiyena Subhavena
Pratiyena Subhavena
Bhagavanna Bhimashvita
Bhagavanna Bhimashvita
Uvayor antaram yoma
Uvayor antaram yoma
Ye rudra parshadam gana
Ye rudra parshadam gana
Artyena subhavena
Artyena subhavena
Bhagavanna bhimashrita
Bhagavanna bhimashrita
Uvayor antaram yoma
Uvayor antaram yoma
Ye rudra parshadam gana Kartiyena subhavena Bhagavanna bhimashrita Uvayor antaram yoma Ye rudra parshadam gana
Kartiyena subhavena
For excessive development of the third mode of material nature. The mode of ignorance. Svabhavena. For such nature.
Bhagavat
Nabhim. The
abdominal navel of the gigantic form of the personality of Godhead. Ashita, those who are so situated, Rupayo, between the two, Antaram, in between, Yoma, the sky, all of whom, I'm sorry, yay, all of whom, Rudra Parshadam, associates of Rudra, Rana, population. Translation purport as the line ratio of Prabhupada. Living entities who are associates of Rudra develop in the third world of material nature or ignorance. They are situated in the sky between the earthly planets and the heavenly planets. Report. The middle portion of the sky is called Bhuvar Loka. That's confirmed by both Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti and Srila Jiva Goswami. In Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that those who develop in the mode of passion are situated in the middle region. Those who are situated in the mode of goodness are promoted to the regions of the demigods. Those who are situated in the mode of passion are placed in human society, and those who are situated in the mode of ignorance are placed in the society of animals or ghosts. There are no contradictions in this conclusion. Numerous living entities are distributed all over the universe in different planets, and so situated in terms of their own qualities in the modes of material nature. Om Vyana Kamandisha, Vyana Janasarakha, Chakshadhanu Kamandu Kasma Shri Kuru Namaha. Panchako Pachu Vishcha, Kriya Sindhu Devi Cha, Kapitana Kavani Kuru Vaishnu Yuru Namaha. So today, try to extract a few things from the verse in purport. I'm going to talk a little bit about Lord Shiva, or Rudra, who's mentioned here, a little bit about the planetary systems, and then somewhat about how the living entities are situated all over the universe and how they're suffering or experiencing the difficulties within this material world, and a little bit about how they may resolve that difficulty and get out. So that's the, what we're covering today. Lord Rudra, or Lord Shiva, is mentioned here. The divinity of Lord Shiva is discussed quite a bit by Srila Prabhupada in several places, and sometimes we hear this analogy of yogurt and milk in regards to Lord Shiva. So, is he Krishna or is he not Krishna? Well, he's both. He has some of the qualities of Krishna, of Vishnu-tattva, but he's not really Vishnu-tattva. And he is also above the qualities of the ordinary living entities, or the jiva. So he is not jiva and he is not Vishvatattva. He's sort of in his own category, his own class. And probably would give the example of milk and yogurt. How milk transforms to yogurt, so you can say it's the same, but on the other hand, it's different. Because yogurt can't transform back to milk. It's not usually anything. I was kind of thinking about this, and I saw that this analogy, the first place I think in our scriptures that it's used, probably historically at least, is the Brahma Samhita. Verse chapter 5, of course, is Brahma Samhita. It's all of chapter 5. The text 44 says, I worship Govinda, the original person, who takes the form of Shambhu in the manner that milk becomes yogurt by special transformation, but is still not a separate tattva from milk, its cause. So it's discussed there in Brahma Samhita and other scriptures how this relationship with Krishna and Shiva is there. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains it. He says, though Shiva is considered to be like yogurt or dahi, yogurt is nothing but transparent milk. Nonetheless, yogurt cannot be accepted as milk. Similarly, though Shiva holds almost the powers of Lord Vishnu, he is also above the qualities of the living entity. But he's not exactly like Vishnu, just as yogurt, although transformed milk, is not exactly like milk. So that's really pretty clear. And what's the main difference? What is the main difference between Vishnu, who is also, of course, Lord Shiva is also misformed, a Guna avatar, and Lord Vishnu is also considered, in one sense, a Guna avatar, in the word of Guna. So what is the difference? because Shiva associates with more vividness, exactly. When Krishna or any of his plenary expansions, such as the Purusha avatars, even when they come into this material world, they never actually contact or touch matter, material energy. Or Shiva, because of the work that he has to do, promoting the modes of ignorance, and also his primeval or primordial work in helping to create the material universe, he does have to have contact with the material nature. Therefore, he's not exactly of the Vishnu Tattva category, although he shouldn't be considered lesser or should never be disrespected in any way. And he's also first considered to be the greatest Vaishnava. And he continually worships Krishna. We do not worship Lord Shiva, but we do understand that we can respect him as a great Vaishnava devotee of the Lord. Okay. Now, when it comes to this material world, he's called Rudra. In this verse, it's mentioned he is Rudra. So, of course, there is a... In the spiritual world, Shiva is also there. I think Rupa's trying to talk a little bit about this in the Sunday feast, that there are many of the energies can both be spiritual and material. So it just says, so there is a form of Shiva in the spiritual world, but then he has several transformations. Actually, and then he comes into this material world for the purpose of creation as Rudra. In Bhakti Murtak Kaur's commentary on this verse in the Brahma Samhita, well, most of us are pretty familiar with Bhaktivedanta's commentary on the Brahma Samhita. I think that's one of the first copies. But also Jiva Goswami and Bhakti Murtak Kaur also wrote really nice commentaries on Brahma Samhita. So this is from Bhakti Murtak Kaur's. He said, the Sarup is which is an abbas of the Lord's Svansha and endowed with that special transformation manifests Sadashiva, the form of effulgent linga or Shambhu, and from him manifests Rudra. In the form of Shambhu, a Vibhanansha assuming the mood of a Svansha, I'm not going to get into this now, in order to produce Upadana or material elements of creation, destroy demons, during maintenance and carry out his destruction, he is a guna avatar of Govinda. The meaning is that Shambhu, by the shakti of time, according to the desire of Govinda, along with Durga, carries out his activities. So, of course, Durga is also an expansion, ultimately of Lakshmi, ultimately Radharani, but she is also comes into this material world in contact with material nature, along with Shiva, and help to bring about the creation of living in this material world. And we've been discussing for quite some time here the different aspects of this material world and the different cosmological considerations and what's going on here, what's the structure of the planets, which is also described here. I find that cosmology is quite complicated. I don't claim to have a great understanding of it in depth. In fact, I think I'm in good company because I think that our TOVP cosmology team of all these people with much bigger brains than me, scientists, philosophers, have years and years studying all the scriptures and everything to try to understand themselves what's really going on, so they can create the blended heritage. Because they have to get it right. You know, the king spent all this money and build this huge planetarium, and then some scholar comes in and says, he can really have that right. So they've been, you know, really, really working on this for years, as far as I understand, to try to understand how it fits together. And it's not simple, is it? Because, you know, you hear descriptions, and some of the descriptions of, like in the fifth canto, are linear, not linear, if linear is our word, describe so many miles, so many yojanas between this system and this system, but sometimes they're described as islands, and like concentric circles and things like that. So there seems to be multi-dimensions in the way the universe can be understood, which very little of this I really understand. But I can understand that it is very complex, and Krishna has arranged this all very nicely to fulfill many purposes in this material universe. The simplest understanding I have is there's 14 planetary systems, 6 lower planetary systems, the Patala Loka system. Earth is more or less the 7th, but that's considered the middle. You know, this 14, 7 is right, and something slightly below, mathematically, but anyway, it's there. It's in the Bhuvaloka system, the middle, but above that is the Bhuvaloka system, which has been mentioned today.
Interestingly enough, because it's Lord Shiva's realm of the world of ignorance, and it mentions ghosts and things like that, anger and perhaps demoniac forms, but they're actually the Buddha Loka is above Guru Loka, because it said it's in the middle place in the sky between Guru Loka and Svarga Loka, which is opposed to higher planetary systems where the demigods are. That's kind of interesting. And I was kind of wondering about this, and I looked at a little bit, and I found that in the 5th canto description, that is how it's described. And then here again in the 11th canto, 11:14-12, in the Bhagavatam, it says, heaven was established as the residence of the demigods, Bhuvaloka as that of the ghostly spirits, and the earth system is a place of human beings and others in these three divisions. So, anyway, that's the way it's set up. Even though we might think of demigods in the mode of goodness on their planet, more of passion and ignorance probably mixed, and then this planetary system of Rudra being more in the mode of ignorance, which is between the two. So I think the point is that the living entities are distributed everywhere throughout this universe, and that's the point I think the prophet's making at the end, where he says there's no contradiction. In other words, you may look at things in different ways. Are they here? Are they here? Where are the different people and the different modes, the different animals, everything? They're distributed everywhere. So you both have animals on Bhuvaloka in the mode of ignorance, and you also have animals on the Earth planet in the mode of ignorance. And you have people, human beings, you know, they're also in the different modes. So, in other words, however it's described, it's not contradictory. There's lots of living entities everywhere and in all different modes. You know, that's at least my sort of simple understanding here. That we don't need to overly complicate it to exactly where everybody is situated, because it's not that simple. So, living entities are everywhere in the universe. That is a fact. And Krishna has made all of these arrangements to fulfill the desires of different living entities. So according to one's desire, and of course according to one's work, one's karma, one is situated in different planets and in different bodies. That is, it's both deserve and desire. So it's according to desires, but it's also according to the karma or the work of those living entities as far as what they're qualified for. In the Bhagavad Gita 14.4, Sri Prabhupada in his purport says, the living entities are combinations of the material nature and the spiritual nature. In other words, the spirit soul enters the material body, so therefore this is a combination. You have both the soul within us, and of course we have this material body we're carrying around with us. Such living entities are seen not only on this planet, but on every planet, even on the highest where Brahma is situated. Everywhere there are living entities. Within the earth, there are living entities, even within water and within fire. And it's also mentioned, Bhagavad Gita 2.24, the word there is Sarvagata. It says the living entities are Sarvagata, which means they're situated everywhere. And Prabhupada says the word Sarvagata, all-pervading, is significant because there's no doubt that living entities are all over God's creation. They live on the land, in water, in the air, within the earth, and even within fire. Therefore, there is no doubt that living entities are also the sun planet, a suitable body to live there. Now, many people who are probably not devotees or who don't ascribe to the Srimad Bhagavatam might find some of these statements extraordinary. Huh? Living entities like us, you know, in fire, and all these things? But it's really not that difficult to understand. It's really not that hard to believe, because even on this earth planet, we can find many, many examples of living entities in all sorts of extraordinary places where human bodies or entities and bodies like us would not survive for a second. I've found some examples of this. For instance, in the Antarctic, where it's below freezing, there's 400 species of lichen and 100 species of moss. Now, not a very developed living entity, but nevertheless, a great variety in the frozen ice of Antarctica. And if you go down to the deepest ocean trenches, over 5 miles down, where the water pressure at that depth is thousands of times greater than on the surface, so that would just like crush almost anything. There are species of fish that live there. Is somehow adapted to that very, very hostile environment. And I thought another one was strange. You go 1 mile into the ground, under the ground, a mile down, 5,000 feet. There's very little oxygen, and it's very, very hot. And there are these nematodes, these little worms live there. So, material bodies have survived. Conditions have been boiled, frozen, crushed, dried out, blasted into space, whatever. Somehow, that struggle for survival is there, and the living entities try to persevere in any condition. They seem to find ways to survive, so that struggle for survival is always there. I was going to say that struggle to endure in this material world is there, but it's hard to understand exactly how the nematode and the fish are enjoying very much in those conditions. But nevertheless, they are trying. Which, in a sense, is no more, we think, well, that just seems ridiculous. You know, it's no more ridiculous than us trying to enjoy, as we do in this material world. We just don't have more sophisticated ways of doing it. We have more facility. We have more advanced intelligence. We have, you know, we have better senses. We have so many things. But yet, the basic motivation is quite similar. You know, to many other plants and living things, somehow to survive and try to enjoy whatever they can within that environment. So, despite the struggle and the desire to enjoy material life or survive is always there. I think it's been some years. I talked about the red tide. I can't remember that. Hopefully, good. Okay. I can repeat a story after a few years, you know, because of the new audience, you know. Anyway, here's my story of the red tide. And the metaphor here is, this is my spoiler, the metaphor is that the material world looks like it's nice, but it chokes us like the red tide. Okay, what's the red tide? Several years ago, I got somehow kind of talked into my family of origin, material family, you know. They all wanted to get together in Florida. So what could I do? Usually I make an excuse because I'm too far away, but you know, they're coming to Florida, it's hard to get out of it. So anyway, they got this really nice place, somewhere south of Sarasota, you know, where we're down there, on the, I can't remember where it was, on the Gulf Coast, you know, which is really nice, and a little kind of resort area, and nice places. So we're all going down there, and, you know, it looked really nice, and we're right on the beach, right? Yeah. We go out, and what's the point? Coughing and choking. And it got worse and worse, and some people were like, you know, couldn't breathe. And what we found out is there was this condition called the red tide, which is this huge floating mass of algae that every once in a while, every few years, comes into, you know, the Gulf of Mexico and comes down and releases this horrible, like, poisonous gas almost. So we were down for 3 or 4 days, and we had to stay inside the entire time because it was too dangerous to go outside. So I thought, man, that's how the material world, I didn't care that much. That's how the material world, it gave me a good story, you know, that, you know, the material world looks really nice, but what does it do? It chokes us and kills us in the end, you know, no matter how attractive it is. Looking out the windows, it just was beautiful down there, you know, but no. And so things like that happen, and, you know, our desires are so often thwarted. As many times as we feel satisfied or fulfilled in our pursuit of enjoyment in the material world, which we sometimes do, there's a little enjoyment here, but just as often, it's the opposite, you know. Or maybe this wasn't really so much a material example, but I went to Italy almost about 10 years ago. I was putting on a training program for child protection in Europe, where the European leaders were coming there. And so after it was over, I had an extra day or two. We were in, it's a really nice temple. It's called Bogdan something. That's near Venice in Italy. And I forget, anyway. It was about, you know, 3 or 4 miles from Venice, you know, which is a very popular tourist area, you know, the canals and everything in Venice. So one of the roadies there wanted to take me there. And I said, well, pretty sure, as long as I'm in Italy, might as well, you know, check it out, whatever. And there's also, they have this cathedral there that's very well known. St. Mark's, I think it is. Anybody ever been there? I think St. Mark's Cathedral is very beautiful and everything. So I went there in December. Because, you know, I don't think about, you know, the way we just have service today, we don't think about what time of year it is so much or anything, right? you know, kind of worked out my schedule, so we set us in December. Also, plane fares are cheaper, going to Europe. It's very expensive flying from the summer to Europe. So there we are in this, in, you know, December. And so we go out to Venice, and there's a strange thing that happens. I always thought Venice just had canals and was on the land or something. It's not. It's an island out in the ocean. And that's just ocean water. It's very low, and that's ocean water. Well, what happened in the winter is the sea level rises. So it was all flooded. So we went there, and you know, the only way you could get into that famous cathedral was they had these sort of ramps and, you know, everything set up in boards and planks and everything, and you could kind of get in somehow. There was like 2 feet of water in the whole thing. My host was very disappointed. I said, don't worry about it. I said, this is a great story. I mean, it just shows us how things are, how, you know, we're so easily disappointed. You know, but anyway, then he took me to his house afterwards, and his wife put the best Italian meal I've ever heard of or seen in my entire life. So my enjoyment was fulfilled with the Italian. That was all, that was fine for me. So, but anyway, we falsely identify with the pains and pleasures of the body and the senses. We tend to act on those desires, trying to fulfill the desires of the body, the senses, and the mind and intelligence are all implicated in this. And therefore, we become increasingly implicated in the karmic reactions and birth and rebirth. So, that's the living entities in the material world. In fact, what that means basically is they are struggling. My famous verse, of course, 15:7, the Mayavan Show, Jiva Loke, Jiva Bhutas, Sanatana. Manishastan and Andriyani, Prakriti Stani Karshati. The living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmented parts. Due to conditioned life, they're struggling very hard with the six senses, which includes the mind. And I think we can say that that struggle in Kali Yuga definitely includes the mind. In fact, the mind sometimes is the biggest struggle. We see, and Prabhupada, of course, has mentioned this as a Kali Yuga symptom, you know, is that the mind is always disturbed, right? That's in the 12th canto. You know, the mind is always disturbed. So we can be in a very poor country, and you see people very disturbed by lack of actual necessities of life. And you can be in a more wealthy country like America, where most people, you know, not everybody, but most people are pretty well off, pretty well fed. They're not really suffering that much. And yet people suffer just as much, if not more so, due to mental difficulties, mental suffering, which afflicts so many people. You know, I mean, the actual statistics on disorders, mental illness, things like this is pretty amazing. I think something like 40% of the population has a major depressive episode once in their life. I mean, you know, so it's like everybody's suffering, basically. You sometimes feel that, you know, you're a little anxious or depressed, but you're not alone. Everybody is, basically. And because the material world is not satisfying, and so many things causes anxiety and causes difficulties. So therefore, parsity, always struggling. And from the highest planet to the lowest, all are places of misery, which it tells us in 8:16. So it's not like we can find a better situation. That's the difficulty. Most people in the material world, even if they'll acknowledge or feel very much of their suffering, they think the question or the solution is to find a better situation, right? Okay, I'm suffering, but if I had more money, if I lived in a better place, if I did this, if I did that, I had a better husband, a better wife, if I had, you know, in other words, solve the problem by getting something better. But there isn't any something better that's satisfying, because Krishna's saying, I don't want you to go to Lord Brahma's planet, and you'll be miserable. Why? Although the residents don't seem to be miserable, because birth and death occur. Now, admittedly, for the highest, most advanced residents of Brahma Loka, at the end of the total annihilation, they do go back and make the Godhead. But basically speaking, almost everybody else in this material world continues the process of birth and death. In 8:5:30, Srimad Bhagavatam, it says, no one can overcome the Supreme Personality of Godhead's illusory energy, Maya, which is so strong that it bewilders everyone, making one lose the sense to understand the aim of life. So it's not just that it makes us miserable, it makes us not understand. We lose that consciousness. The consciousness gets covered, so we don't even know what the purpose of life is. We can't even really see it. We're suffering and why we're suffering. And that's the problem of religion. The prime cause of suffering is avidya, according to the spiritual authorities and the acharyas. Ignorance. Because of ignorance and ultimate ignorance of who we are. We don't understand that we are part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that we are devotees meant to serve the Supreme Person, Krishna. And because of that, all the suffering begins. So we can't really enjoy this world because it's not our rightful place. Nothing will feel correct. And so the living entities attempt to forget Krishna in joy in many ways. And even though we may seem to be trapped in this endless cycle of material world, it is not our real identity. And if we can, through the process of knowledge, begin to understand who we really are, what is our real identity, then we begin to wake up and get out of this dream of the material world, out of this illusion that this is our real home. And that, of course, that verse 15:7, Prabhupada says in a purport, every living entity as an individual soul has his personal individuality in a minute form of independence. By misuse of that independence, one becomes a conditioned soul, and by proper use of independence, he becomes liberated. In his liberated state, he is freed from material conditioning under the engagement of transcendental service unto the Lord. In his conditioned life, he is dominated by the material modes of nature and forgets the transcendental loving service of the Lord. That fragmented portion, when liberated from bodily entanglement, revives his original spiritual body in the spiritual sky and the spiritual planet and enjoys association with the Supreme Lord. So that's our great hope, that that is there, if we can get out of this material conditioning. The irony is, by surrendering to Krishna, we become liberated. By struggling independently, we are conditioned and controlled by our material nature and by the modes of nature. People say, why don't you want to surrender? But they've already surrendered to the material modes of nature. And by surrendering to Krishna, one becomes free. And becomes liberated from that condition. Real freedom is to become free from the modes of nature and aligned with Krishna's desires. So we experience real freedom as devotees, freedom from suffering, freedom from death, freedom from ignorance, freedom from being disconnected with the purpose of life and Krishna's plan, Krishna's desires, and also freedom from being alone. I was thinking that, but everyone in the material world is really alone, right? Even if you're surrounded by friends or family relationships, especially at the time of death, you know, it's like you're alone. You know, they say you have to, it's like you have to fly a plane solo at a certain point. You know, it's about you and your relationship. And so the way to not be alone, of course, is to be with Krishna. The devotee learns to experience the presence of Krishna always, or at least we know he's there. If we don't always experience Krishna every moment, at least we know that he is. We have the faith that Krishna's with us. Krishna's traveling with every living entity within our heart. It's the super soul, it's the Paramatma. So we want to get that point by surrendering what Krishna is saying. Revive the spiritual body and go to the spiritual plane of Krishna. So how do we do that? How do we become liberated from this bodily enjoyment, bewilderment, from this strong rose of material nature, the coverings which have been going on for lifetimes, which seems so difficult, so thick to try to get out of, even as devotees? It's like, it's still something we feel like we're struggling, you know, to not be afflicted by the rose of material nature. And it is difficult, especially those in Kali Yuga who have been so long in this material world. But one official's greatest qualities is the quality of mercy. This for the devotees. That is one of his greatest qualities. Krishna wants the jiva to get out of this material world. He does not want us to suffer. He wants us to return to him in a loving relationship. Now what do we have to do? Ultimately, we just have to agree. We just have to say, Krishna, yes, okay. I agree. I want to return to you. I will love you again. I will serve you again. Once the basic surrender process is there, then we're really just talking about time. Right? We continue the process where we certainly come out of time. Now what is that time? It can be 1 minute, it can be a few lifetimes, you know, it depends upon every individual, upon our relationship with Krishna and our relationship with Prabhupada or a spiritual master, and developing faith, surrender, love, relationship, service. All of these things that we all know, that we do every day. We just need to continue these processes over whatever that period of time is till we actually become free from the suffering material world and are really situated again in our constitutional position as servant of Krishna. And of course, Krishna's love and mercy is so much there for us. And so we just have to somehow accept it and feel it and experience it. And I was thinking a couple of days ago, which happened in Gokadina, it's such a wonderful, wonderful time to experience that mercy. And I think anyone who is here would, to some degree, I can imagine that most of the devotees felt that because it was just such a wonderful, auspicious day and such a wonderful festival. There were like thousands of people here, it seemed like. And they were getting Lord Chaitanya's mercy. The mercy is your own time. And that is the very, very special opportunity we have as Vaishnavas, as devotees, being situated here, now, in this place, on this planet, at this time in history. That we're only 500 years after the wonderful, glorious appearance of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who came to deliver the universe, to give his mercy to every living entity, to bring the chanting of the holy name to every town and village. And very, very recently, he sent his great devotee, Srila Prabhupada, to come and deliver that message to the Western world. And if anyone doesn't agree with that, I will gladly debate you. And I don't think I've got a lot of dissent on that. Yes. Srila Prabhupada certainly had the mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the empowerment. Who else could come 7 years old with a very odd, I shouldn't say odd, but to Americans, kind of an odd culture. You know, it's not like something, oh yeah, sure, you just immediately understand what that's about, wearing dhotis and yeah. No, it was strange. But yet we did. But yet Srila Prabhupada had that potency to get us to understand, to wake up. He broke that chain of avidya, of ignorance, and we started to feel Krishna's love through the chanting of the holy name. Because Krishna and his name are different, and once the chanting is there, then it starts to come about. I was thinking of similar to what happened during the festival. Everything Lord Chaitanya gave us, I'm not sure Prabhupada gave us too. You know, everything we experienced, from the chanting of holy names going on everywhere outside in the temple room, prasadam we distributed. I didn't stay around till the end, but they had huge, huge stacks of prasadam. The plays were going on, there's so many things, the deity worship, it was like a line of people from Maid going to town, like all through the afternoon and evening. And there was the philosophy. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu distributed Krishna consciousness in different ways to different classes of people. To ordinary people, to average people, he was chanting, dancing, feasting. Which still is very, very nice for all of us. But then he also spoke philosophy. And, you know, we have, of course, Prabhupada chronicled that quite early, but I don't know, when was the teaching to Lord Chaitanya, 1970, 71? You know, the five primary conversations, Prabhupada Saraswati, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Rupa Goswami, Sananta Goswami, and Ramananda Roy. Well, there, in other words, this is, those were the, well, many other places, but those were some of the primary places where Lord Chaitanya disseminated the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And then those followers, of course, especially Rupa Goswami and Sananta Goswami, continued the writing and explicated the philosophy of Krishna consciousness and their followers in the six Goswamis. That was there. I've been rereading Chaitanya Charitamrita systematically through and reading much of Lila. And so much in those early chapters, his tour of South India, he was just distributing Krishna consciousness freely at this point. At this point, he was just giving it out. I'm just going to read a few verses here from, about a couple minutes. From Rajalila, I'm going to switch gears here from the achieving the planetary systems. Anyway, but starting 113, chapter 7, when Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to the holy place, as known as Puri Kshetra, he saw the deity and offered prayers and obeisances. Now at this place, Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in his usual ecstasy of love of Godhead. He was laughing, crying, dancing, and chanting. Everyone saw him as astonished. After hearing these wonderful occurrences, everyone came to see him there. When they saw the beauty and his ecstatic condition, they were all struck with wonder. Just by seeing Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, everyone became a devotee. They began to chant Krishna and Hare and all the holy names. They all were moved in a great ecstasy of love. They began to dance, raising their arms. Always hearing them chant the holy names of Lord Krishna, the residents of all the other villages also became Vaishnavas. By hearing the holy name of Krishna, the entire country became Vaishnava. It was as if the nectar of the holy name was overflooding the entire country. Continuing, after this, Lord Chaitanya shows that everyone in every status of life can be Krishna conscious. I'm running out of time, but anyway, we begin with the story of Purna Brahma, Rama, whom he preached to, who became very attracted, and he wanted to travel with him, leave his family, and he became renounced. And Lord Chaitanya didn't care for that, did he? He said, he begged him to take him with him, and Lord Chaitanya said, "Do not speak like that again. Better to remain at home and chant the holy name of Krishna always. Instruct everyone to follow the orders of Sri Krishna as they were given in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. In this way, become a spiritual master and try to liberate everyone in this land." Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu further advised the Brahmin Purna, "If you follow these instructions, your materialistic life at home will not obstruct your spiritual advancement. Indeed, if you follow these regular principles, we will again meet here, or rather, you will never lose my company." So, again, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu making it very simple and easy for everyone. You don't have to become renounced. We have a few renounced members in our community who are wonderful examples for us. They are our teachers. But for those of us in household life, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was saying, it is not a problem. You chant the holy names, you teach Krishna consciousness to others, you help to spread this movement, and he says, you will never lose my company. Lord Chaitanya will be with us. We will have his mercy, we will have his empowerment, as long as we are following the instructions given to us by Srila Prabhupada and chanting the holy name sincerely. And he really, he's not stopping. And that space, that distance between getting to the end goal and where we are becomes smaller and smaller. Okay. Shadendra, thank you very much. Questions, comments? Maharaj?
Thank you for some of the whirlwind tour of the different points related. Would it be all right if I shared one shloka, because I see it as almost as if the shloka can serve as a succinct purport to what the verse and the purport today was about. We're talking about, we're hearing about the relationship between the modes of nature and different living entities in this world. Is that all right?
Okay.
This has been the chapter about the Lord is equal to everyone. And I don't have to tell you the exact text.
Yeah, 7:1-8.
7:1-8. Jayam kaleti sattva sattva evarshin rajasho shuram tamaso yaksha lakshan shi tatkarvam guno vachat. Translation, when the quality of goodness is permanent, the sages and demigods flourish with the help of that quality with which they are infused and surcharged by the Supreme Word. Similarly, when the mode of passion is permanent, the demons flourish. And when ignorance is permanent, the yakshas and rakshasas flourish. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is present in everyone's heart, fostering the reactions of sattva-gun, rajagun, and tamo-gun. That relates to how the Lord is equal to everyone. I'm kind of blaming on the modes. also, just as a little, it's almost like dessert or something. It's just a detail. But you were talking about how different living entities have this amazing ability to adapt to the most, unlikely environment. So I have been going a lot to Trinidad, and they have a type of plant that somehow grows in electric wires, and how they get their food, and it's inconceivable. But there's even a more amazing example. There's a type of fish, it's a cold-blooded, of course, and they're so far north, above the Arctic Circle, that the water there somehow is so cold that the blood of the fish would normally freeze. And by Lord Brahma's amazing contrivance, some people say it just evolved somehow, they have antifreeze. Within the body of the fish, they all generate something very similar to, the same, at least functionally, the same thing as antifreeze. So it's a kind of natural antifreeze that prevents their blood from freezing up. So somehow Krishna takes care of all of them. Hare Krishna.
Well, that's certainly an interesting, I'm sure that was all just evolved by chance. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Okay. I'll go into your bar.